the Sociology and Animals podcast series. This is Dr. Corey Wren. I'm a lecturer in sociology with the University of Kent in Canterbury, England, and I'm the past chair of the Animals and Society section of the American Sociological Association. I'm also the co-founder, along with Dr. Zoe Sutton, of the International Association of Vegan Sociologists. And part of that organization's larger goal is to help normalize vegan studies from a sociological perspective. And so this podcast is helping to bring shape to this burgeoning field and help to demystify some of the work that we're doing, and of course to help build networks. In the first season, we really focused on how to get into the field and how to succeed in the field, and it was really oriented towards students and early career sociologists. In this season, too, what I've done is I've interviewed some of the major thinkers in the field and just asked them to survey, you know, what's going on in the different areas that they're specializing in and how has veganism or critical animal studies informed that field? What are some of the challenges that they're facing and so on? So let's get started.
Welcome, Tobias Linné.
Thank you.
Close enough. Okay. The love of my life, my reason for living. Can you please introduce yourself and your work?
Well, like you said, I'm Tobias. I'm a sociologist and an animal rights activist. I work in Lund University in south of Sweden. And I'm teaching media studies and doing research in media cultural studies.
What's it all about, and how is it historically understood, non-human animals?
Well, as a sociologist, you also know that, you know, animals haven't really been considered part of the social, even though they've always been, of course. So I guess historically, the field, if I'm speaking about the field of media studies, it hasn't acknowledged animals at all, I would say. I mean, not in the same way that we critically analyze all other representations. Which is strange, of course, because especially nowadays we're teaching, you know, critical media analysis and all of this, but we just stop, you know, at the human, with the humans, which I mean, it's not that strange. I mean, that's what humanist science is about. But on the one hand, I think what is interesting with media studies, looking at it from a critical animal studies perspective or a perspective on non-human animal relations, is that on the one hand, we have so much media that is about animals. I mean, children's media, obviously, but I mean, popular cultural media, it's saturated with animals. And there's so many animals, and then there is so little, like in media studies, almost nothing about like dealing with these questions about representation of animals, for example. Yeah. So, I guess it's like in many fields in social sciences that animals have been neglected because they haven't been seen as part of the social. So they've been invisible, basically, for media studies scholars, even critical media studies scholars. As it happened, I got this position because media and sociology are very close, at least here in Sweden. We're like in the organization. So I've been trying to work. I'm working a little with Sweden's biggest animal rights organization called Djurens Rätt. We've formed a little, group sort of to discuss these questions, to invite, you know, academics and, you know, activists to talk about how to communicate about animal rights and these kind of things. So we're trying to learn from each other. I'm not good enough, you know. I'm not a communication practitioner. So I think, you know, building these bridges between people who are, you know, activists and doing, you know, the media work themselves and us who are analyzing the media, I think that's an important thing.
Yeah, actually, very much so. Why don't you tell me, how has the field really been challenged or advanced by critical animal studies?
Well, I think it happened quite recently. I mean, and then I'm like thinking, I mean, in the last like 10 last decade, I've seen people trying starting to discuss this, you know, starting to ask questions about how representation was the first thing, you know, in media studies, like how do we represent animals in news media, for example. So critical animal studies scholars have challenged you know, journalists for how they portray animals in their news stories, and how, I mean, how we write about them. I mean, how we represent animal agency, for example, in the news media. Or, I mean, how, do we even use, you know, it when referring to an animal individual? So I think the field, I mean, practitioners have been challenged by people, you know, saying that we should be more mindful about how we represent animals in the news, but of course also in advertising, in popular culture at large, in entertainment, in nature documentaries, everything. So that's been a challenge. And I mean, academically, that has meant that sort of, how to phrase it, critical animal studies people or animal rights activists have asked, you know, media scholars to use the same perspectives that we are using when we're looking at representation of human minority groups. I mean, to look at those representations. And also, and I mean, I think this question is what's never is asked about animals. And also ask, you know, how does that affect the actual animals, you know, that are in the real world? I mean, so I would say, like, media studies have neglected it. But, I mean, and then, you know, maybe some media studies scholars have been interested in how are animals represented. But the connection made to, you know, how are, you know, real animals treated is very seldom made. So I think the challenge for the field of media studies is to employ the same strategies that we are using when we're analyzing human minority groups and representations of different groups of people on animals, to use the same like tools of analysis.
It's getting through though, isn't it? I feel like I've seen through news channels like the discussion about it that's been just very recently they've been pushing back. So it's getting through beyond our field, isn't it?
It is. And it's interesting you mentioned it. I've been getting it in my Instagram feed. These, you know, guidelines for fair representation or something like that. And that's something I saw the first time, could have been like 3 years ago, like from some critical animal studies media scholars, Matthew Cole and Carrie Freeman and Nuria in Barcelona. And I remember they had these guidelines for journalists, which was basically a list, you know, like, think about this. If you're a journalist, you know, think about how you represent animal agency. And so now I saw that some animal rights organizations had sort of picked up some of these things. PETA had something I saw. So it is interesting, that it seems to have, spread. And I'm curious to see where it's going to end up. I had some discussion about this with some, media people in Sweden too. And what their thoughts were about it, and it's interesting. I think if for many media people, this is very, very far out, you know. Yeah,
because that book you're referencing, Critical Animal and Media Studies, that was like 2016 or something, right?
Yeah. So I'm interested to see, and of course, I mean, there is, at least in Sweden, I guess. In the UK as well. I mean, there is a discussion, a bigger discussion about representation of humans, of course, in the media. So I think that's also aiding, you know, this cause that people are starting to think more about these things. And then, of course, one thing that I see lacking in this is, of course, that today almost everyone or a lot of people are media producers themselves, posting stuff. And so, I mean, when we're speaking of, you know, how can we promote fairer representations, it's not only working against, you know, big media organizations. It's also about, you know, normal people posting and creating media content, including animals, many times, of course. Mm-hmm.
This is something that when I teach these topics, my students latch onto. They really get intrigued by the objectifying language and also the intersectionality of a lot of that language that tends to be not just speciesist, but also sexist. And they just really, really get excited about that language bit, which also gives me hope, because if the younger generations are are being swayed by that argument or finding it relevant and interesting, like this old fogey kind of, you know, I just can't believe people would throw up arms over the word it. Like, it just seems so antiquated.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I feel my students also are very engaged in this. So we have this one in this course, we have this one lecture where we're actually talking. Because I think one point to be made about media representation of animals is that most representations, or many of them in popular culture, are quite, you know, nice and cute and, you know, doesn't seem to be harmful. And I sort of want to challenge that idea among my students. So we had this seminar where we're looking at, you know, funny animal videos and trying to, you know, think about, like, what's funny with them and, of course, why people watch them. But also, you know, is this harmful for the animal in any way? You know, is this just a cute cat video? And the students loved it, and I loved it, too. And it gave so much to think about because, I mean, we all send these memes and, you know, videos, and often animals are included in them. And it was quite a challenge, you know, to start thinking about, you know, cute cat videos as oppressive or exploitative or as, you know. But it opened up, like, for really interesting discussions about the appearance of media and popular of animals in popular culture.
Can you give an example of one of these videos?
Excuse me?
Can you give an example of one of these videos?
Well, I mean, many of them include animals hurting themselves. So it could be like a cat, you know, falling, hurting. I mean, of course, we don't know what happens after the clip. We just see this little funny clip. Or, you know, there was this trend with some years ago where people were putting a cucumber behind their cat, you know, to scare the cat.
Yeah, I remember that one.
I see her smiling.
I don't know why that worked, though. That's not funny.
I heard it, but, you know, that became this viral trend. And, I mean, I know too little about this, but, I mean, the cat is scared, you know, and it looks like it's in distress or something, and we laugh at it. And I just wanted, you know, to is that funny? Or would you do that to your cat? Or I don't know.
Of course, because it became viral, lots and lots and lots and lots of people tortured their cat, basically. Yeah, that's a very good example.
Of course. And I mean, I don't know if the cat is actually hurt by that or not. But I don't think that's the point either, you know, because the point is that we're laughing at this cat that is, you know, seemed to be scared or whatever. I expected my students to think that I was crazy, you know, to start thinking. I mean, but they didn't, you know, they understood this. And I think it's coming. I remember this news a few years ago. Instagram enforced this new policy that they would not show pictures of, you know, people taking selfies with animals that were, you know, held captive and drugged, tigers in Asia or something, you know, like, so they would hide these images that would not be okay content to post. So, I mean, even in the media industries, there are these discussions. And for many, my students, like in their 20s, they don't seem to think that it's so strange, which surprised me.
Mm. Well, it's a bit of a bias because I also get really excited when my students fall for they're like, yeah, this is it. But yeah, but then again, they took this class, so.
I know. Yeah, the other day I had made a poster and there was a title of my talk and I was walking in the hallway and there were some students just standing laughing at the title because they thought it was so stupid. And they didn't know, of course, that I was walking behind them. And I didn't say anything.
Either. Aww.
But I wanted to.
That was nice. How dare they? What was the title? Do you remember?
It was something about... it was a stupid title. It was something about dairy cows and oppression. I don't know. But I mean, for us, it's so, I mean, I just realized, you know, that when we speak, we take so much for granted. And then you put it on a poster and put it out in the world and people are just, what are these? It was something milk racism, probably something like that.
Oh, okay. I don't know if that would have been stupid. I think that was just challenging people and their reaction is to laugh at it so they don't have to think about it.
Maybe.
All right, this is more communication study stuff here.
Yeah.
let me ask you this. When you're teaching your students or when you're engaging in the field, you know, what
What are the works that really influenced you? Is there a particular book that you might recommend or an article that stands out?
Well, I would have to say Carol Adams' Sexual Politics of Meat was one of the first books that I read that made, you know, the link between different systems of exploitation and oppression. So that's been hugely. And I think I often recommend it to my students because I think it's a good, easy introduction to this way of thinking.
The Sexual Politics of Meat, easy introduction. I just read that when I was in grad school when I was... I
need to read the foreword. It has like four forewords now. It's been reprinted so many times. I think it's pretty. I mean, I think that the idea of the absent referent and I mean, some of her ideas are quite, I think, easy to take in.
Mm.
Another book that really made an impression on me was Sonara Taylor, Beast of Burden. Where she's linking, human oppression. Yeah, I can't remember what's her concept, but I mean, she talks about how animals are disabled in the animal industries, and she used that lens. That was just opened up a new perspective for me. That's why I liked it. But to start with, oh God, I mean, to have an introduction. I mean, in the field of media studies, there isn't much. I mean, I read Carrie Freeman's book called Framing Farming, which I thought was interesting because I wanted to say that I think one problem with media studies and the interest in these non-human animals and the representations is that we often take for granted, you know, we look at the representations and we do like coding and qualitative coding, but we don't, there's far less studies that actually ask people what they think about representation. I think that's a problem, you know, that because one thing that we've learned from media studies that probably many animal studies people don't have is that, you know, people don't interpret things the way they are presented, you know. The
cow poster talk thing was a good example of that. The cow talk poster.
Yeah, but exactly. I mean, people can see... take something totally else from that, you know, and it's not straightforward. And so I think that's something we need to be much more mindful of. And Carrie Freeman in this book, Framing Farming, what I think she does in a good way is that she actually tries to find empirical, you know, evidence, you know, does this message work or does this message? I mean, I'm not sure I agree with everything that she says, but I mean, she's sort of, should we be pragmatic or, you know, ideological? She's trying to discuss that question. But by actually asking people what they think about different representations. So I think that's something that we need to do much, much more of. And it's hard, of course. It's hard to ask people, you know, what influenced them? How are they affected by media? But it can be done. But it needs to be done thoroughly.
I think the problem there is methodologically speaking. I say this as someone who does a lot of content analysis is I do content analysis, just me in front of the data. I don't have to fool with doing an ethics review. I don't have to fool with interviewing people and all that. I just get through it and it's a lot faster. I think that's one of the major unspoken reasons why people go for content analysis.
Yeah.
But you're right. We do. It's, I'm one person. My interpretation as a critical animal studies person is not going to be like mainstream. So that absolutely. I think that's also something I want to do in this podcast is encourage people not just to think about new ways to apply sociology, but also to be thinking about how they can contribute to this growing field, because this is what I always encourage my students with. So if you guys are interested in this, we need bodies on the ground. We need people doing this research. There's so much we don't know.
Yeah. Still. I think that's great. And like you say, I mean, I've been one thing that I really wanted to do, I mean, I've been teaching this critical animal studies course, but I'm thinking I would like to have like a critical animal studies methodology course, like something like methods for, because I think we really need it. Like you say,
that would be so awesome.
Yeah, it would. So I think that's a big challenge for us as well, to find new methods. And not just stick with the content analysis. And I mean, there are, of course, work being done. And I mean, there are some great innovative people doing, participant stuff, and, with animals, but there needs to be more. Yeah. And especially from media people, because content analysis, like you say, is so common here. And we rarely go out in the field and, ask people. So, yeah. And yet we do so much communication, as activists and as teachers. And we know so little about what actually works.
And then you have a chapter, don't you, in Matthew Cole's book about just how effective your communication is as a teacher, right?
I think I do, yeah. And in that, it was a long time since I wrote it, but I mean, I think we're talking about, breaking down, barriers and opening up, because it's an introductory course. So many people have not studied anything before and are sort of, so we're trying to open up this new perspective. So, yeah, I discussed that. And I discuss, the benefits and the problems with having, because we have a very open approach in this course where we are saying at the first lecture that we're vegan, we are animal rights. That's why we do this course, etc. So I think I'm discussing from that perspective. Yeah.
I wrote a very short article once just because I was marking out exams a few years ago, and it was a regular introductory sociology course. And we had 1 week on speciesism. And just getting to think critically, like gender, race, class, there's no species in there. And it was just an extra credit question on the exam, how many animals on average are killed in the United States every year? And it was just a number that was like, I broadcast it, and it's like in their notes, and it's in their study guide. And the numbers that I was getting back, it was like, all right, there's the people who studied, obviously, but then there's people who were just taking wild guesses who weren't paying attention or whatever. But the guesses they were coming up with, astronomically low, like 2,000 animals are killed every year. Like, I'm not making this up. 10,000 animals are killed. Wow. It was just like shocking to me. First off, like my teaching wasn't working. But secondly, for people who even were just not engaged at all, their basic functional knowledge of the world was so terrible when it comes to animals.
I mean, I've been thinking a lot, like when I'm teaching, because this group that I'm teaching has like around half of the class has an animal rights background, and around half of the class doesn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, it creates a very, I mean, every situation is different when you're communicating about these things. So, I mean, I think it is hard to find some general, I mean, that's the problem, right? There aren't any general guidelines about how to communicate about these things. We need to take in the context. We need to take in the audience. I mean, we know all of that. So there isn't one way to communicate about, animal rights and convince people that it's wrong to kill animals. There has to be different ways. So I've been working with that and trying different strategies in my classes. I think the best strategy has definitely been, I mean, we've been very open with us being vegan and our positions, us as teachers. And I think that has worked really well. I think even for people who don't share our worldview, they still, they still like that.
As long as we're being compassionate, we're just not being phony. And
we're not. I mean, we're respecting their, them too. But we're also saying that this is a course where this is our perspective that we're representing in this course. Yeah. Because we often get that, shouldn't we have the other side? Shouldn't we have like a debate about should we eat meat or not? And that's not what we're doing in this course. Like in this course, we are, taking this one perspective, and the rest of society is taking the other, is telling people to eat meat and everything else. So so that's what we're trying to do in that space, yeah. But it's hard. It's challenging. But I think Carrie Freeman, I think she speaks about ideological authenticity or something, that because when she's discussing, how pragmatic can we be? And I think her conclusion is that we need to keep this at the core, this authenticity at the core. And I truly believe in that. So that's what we're trying to do when we're saying, we are we believe in this, you know, this is our beliefs and this is where we're coming from. Mm. I'm not hiding that. Yeah.
Yeah. So fair to say then in your field, you have basically three areas where you're being critical about communication. The first one would be, as we were just talking about, in the classroom with your students.
Yeah.
The second one would be your field. And then the third would be the activist community. So these are three major areas where you're kind of directing attention and critical thought.
Very nice, Gloria.
I haven't
thought about it like, but yeah, of course.
That's exactly. Well, let me ask you this then. For either of those arms or any of these areas we've talked about, if someone wants to get more involved, like where would you tell them to go? What should they check out? Websites, groups, email?
Well, there is one website by some of these people that I mentioned called animalsandmedia.org. I think it's a good resource. It's like, it features these guidelines that I've been talking about. It has, I think, guidelines for journalists, and then it has for PR practitioners also. And it has some, you know, how to think about when reporting about animals, both visually and, you know, in text. I think that's a good, there are many good ones, but that's a good start, and it links to other places as well. I think it has a very hands-on approach, how to work with media. I just want to mention, I mean, another part of the media interest in animal rights is, of course, also how activists are portrayed, which I didn't mention because we're talking about how animals are portrayed, but of course that's also an important issue, so how the animal rights movement is portrayed and activists within the movement. And I think that's also starting to change a lot in recent years. I did a small study in Sweden, and I mean, of course, that has to do with the vegan food trending. So we see much more positive representations of animal rights activists. There were practically non-existent, like any positive, if we look like in the 90s, in Sweden at least.
Yeah. All right, so my last question for you, my dear, is what do you think vegan sociology is, or what does vegan sociology mean to you, if you had to define it?
Oh, well, personally, I mean, for me, it's a chance to, I mean, I love sociology. I haven't worked in sociology for 20 years, 15 years, but I got my PhD there, and I would love, for me, it means an opportunity to come back to sociology, because I want to do something with animal rights. I mean, it's an important part for me that I can, in my professional life, that I can work with these things. So for me, it means an opportunity.
Thanks for listening to Sociology and Animals. I hope you found it helpful and informative. If you want to learn more about the sociological study of society and animals, you can check out the website of the Animals and Society section of the American Sociological Association or my own website at coreylebrin.com. You can also check out the International Association for Vegan Sociologists, and the website for that is vegansociology.com. Feedback and suggestions can be submitted to myself at coreyrenn@gmail.com. That's coreywrenn@gmail.com. If you liked this episode, be sure to share the series with others. The music for this podcast was provided by Ode to Sleep, a band local to where I live, here in East Kent, England. Ode to Sleep explores various topics with their music, including human and animal rights, environmental issues, equality, and mental health. Until next time, this is Dr. Corey Wren signing off. All the best.